16th century Catholic apologist, and in his assessment of the Anabaptists in his book, Against the Terrible Errors of the Anabaptists, he has this to say. And by the way, that's a great book title. If you disagree with a group, just write The Terrible Errors of, insert name of group here. He says, among the existing heretical sects, there is none which in appearance leads a more modest or pious life than the Anabaptist. As concerns their outward public life, they are irreproachable. No lying, deception, swearing, strife, harsh language, no intemperate eating and drinking, no outward personal display is found among them, but humility, patience, uprightness, neatness, honesty, temperance, straightforwardness, in such measure that one would suppose they have the Spirit of God. It sounds kind of like a list of compliments until he gets to that last part there, that one would suppose they have the Spirit of God. The obvious implication being that he believes they do not have the Spirit of God. Now, it's well known that the Anabaptists were reviled in many ways in 16th century Europe and afterwards, and this, all things considered, is probably a more mild instance of that reviling, but it's a striking instance nonetheless. Many of us in our own lives, to various degrees, I think of a lot of people in this room, have had various experiences where we have been reviled in one way or another, and it might not be as extreme as some of the ways that we've seen other Christians reviled in history, but we still need to learn how to handle these insults, these situations that come to us. So today the question I want to explore is, how do we handle reviling well? We'll be looking at a couple responses to reviling that are found in 2 Samuel chapter 16. So if you have a Bible or a digital Bible, go ahead and turn to 2 Samuel chapter 16. We'll be reading from this chapter mainly, but also drawing on another passage. While you're turning there, to give you some context, in 2 Samuel, David is continuing in his kingship. He's finally been established, and sometime into his kingship, his own son, Absalom, rises up against him and manages to take the hearts of most of Israel with him, and as a result, leads a successful coup against David, and David flees Jerusalem for his life. And chapter 16 is picking up after David has fled Jerusalem. He's just summited the top of the Mount of Olives next to Jerusalem, and now he's coming down, and this is what we learn. When David was a little past the top of the mountain, there was Ziba, the servant of Mephibosheth, who met him with a couple of saddled donkeys, and on them 200 loaves of bread, 100 clusters of raisins, 100 summer fruits, and a skin of wine. And the king said to Ziba, "What do you mean to do with these?" So Ziba said, "The donkeys are for the king's household to ride on, the bread and summer fruit for the young men to eat, and the wine for those who are faint in the wilderness to drink." Then the king said, "And where is your master's son?" And Ziba said to the king, "Indeed, he is staying in Jerusalem, for he said, 'Today the house of Israel will restore the kingdom of my father to me.'" So the king said to Ziba, "Here, all that belongs to Mephibosheth is yours." And Ziba said, "I humbly bow before you, that I may find favor in your sight, my lord, O king." Now when David came to Bahurim, there was a man from the family of the house of Saul whose name was Shimi, the son of Gera, coming from there. He came out cursing continuously as he came. And he threw stones at David and at all the servants of King David. And all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and on his left. Also, Shimei said thus when he cursed, come out, you bloodthirsty man, you rogue. The Lord has brought upon you all the blood of the house of Saul, in whose place you have reigned. And the Lord has delivered the kingdom into the hand of Absalom, your son. So now you are caught in your own evil, because you are a bloodthirsty man. Then Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why should this dead dog curse my lord the king? Please, let me go over and take off his head. And the king said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah? So let him curse, because the Lord has said to him, curse David. Who then shall say, why have you done so? And David said to Abishai and all his servants, see how my son, who came from my own body, seeks my life. How much more now may this Benjamite? Let him alone and let him curse, for so the Lord has ordered him. It may be that the Lord will look on my affliction, and the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing this day. And as David and his men went along the road, Shimei went along the hillside opposite him and cursed as he went, threw stones at him and kicked up dust. Now the king and all the people who were with him became weary, so they refreshed themselves there. Obviously, this is a rather extreme example of reviling, and it's accompanied with physical attacks, physical insults, and Shimei is not pulling his punches here whatsoever. Reviling is the best word I could think of to describe what's going on here, but I feel like it's kind of one of those words that's in the realm of religious jargon, so I would like to just give a modern definition of reviling according to a reputable online dictionary. It's defined as criticism given in an abusive or angrily insulting manner. And synonyms include berating, upbraiding, slander, and abuse. I really like the word abuse because I feel like verbal abuse would be the lingo that people would use for talking about reviling today. So if it helps, think of reviling as verbal abuse. And of course, we're looking at verbal abuse that's directed towards people who are undeserving of that verbal abuse, or at least undeserving of the specific thing that they're being accused of. I'd like to make four points about reviling tonight, just kind of to draw an anatomy of it and how we should respond to it. And the first point is what we should expect from reviling. So I already left you with that definition. Something to add to that that we see in this story is that reviling hits where it hurts. When someone reviles us, they usually know how to take that thing that we detest the most and to impute it to us. And we see that exactly this thing is going on with David. What is, for anyone who's just listening to what I read, what is the kind of one-word answer for what Shimei's accusation against David is?
You said one word?
One word answer. If you have more than one word, you can share that. We'll see if we can narrow in on it.
Usurper.
Usurper, okay. Okay, yeah, that's a good paraphrase. It's a word he actually uses in the text here. The word I would pick out here is bloodthirsty, that David is a bloodthirsty man. Of course, the whole point to this accusation is that Shimei is a member of the household of Saul, and he's accusing David of being bloodthirsty in his dealings with the house of Saul. So let's take a moment to think about David's dealings with the house of Saul. He fought Saul's battles. He served Saul while Saul was alive and while he was king. Even when Saul tried to kill him unjustly and dishonored him on multiple occasions, he had the opportunity to kill Saul twice and passed up that opportunity both times. When Saul finally did meet his demise at the hand of the Philistines, David mourned over Saul's death. In fact, someone came to him reporting Saul's death as if it were good news to him, and David executed the messenger who thought he was bringing good news. He mourned the death of Saul's son, Jonathan. After David's establishment as king, he met challenges from another one of Saul's sons named Ishbosheth, who also tried to claim the throne. And there was a civil war that took place in Israel. And when assassins killed Ishbosheth, Saul's son, and told David about it, David had them executed as well because he did not approve of their actions there. And after all of this, David sought out someone from the household of Saul who was still living with the desire to show kindness to someone from the house of Saul because of Jonathan and his covenant with him. And that was where Mephibosheth comes into the story. Mephibosheth was the lame son of Jonathan. That is, he had an accident while an infant, and he was crippled for life from that. And David takes Mephibosheth, and Mephibosheth comes to him trembling, thinking perhaps David is going to kill him, because this would be a very normal thing for a ruler in the ancient Near East trying to consolidate power to do. But instead of taking violent action against him, David gives Mephibosheth a place at his table and restores the property and the estate of his father that had been taken from him. So all of David's dealings with the house of Saul have been far from bloodthirsty. He's had every opportunity to spill blood, and he's only chosen to show the household of Saul kindness. Also, think about David as the author of about half of the Psalms in our Bible. How many of David's Psalms groan about this very thing? How many of David's Psalms are complaining to God about bloodthirsty men, asking God to deliver him from bloodthirsty men, asking God vowing to God that he wants to depart from the company of bloodthirsty men? And even in this very passage, when David's men want to take off Shimei's head, David is the one who restrains them and says, let him continue to curse. And David refuses, once again, to spill the blood of a member of Saul's household. Interestingly, if he had retaliated, it would have, in a way, proved Shimei right. And I think this is what Shimei actually wanted to happen. Think about a single man, a Benjamite, coming up to this company of David's mighty men and all of the people following him, and he's cursing David, he's throwing stones at all of them. I think he was prepared to die and was very much expecting that David would order to have him killed, and that would have made his accusations against David seem true. But David refuses to do so, and in doing so proves himself more honorable than Shimei. So the point of all of that is to say that when people revile us, they tend to pick out the things that we detest the most, or the things that we want to distance ourselves from the most, and they impute that to us. And we see this again with the Anabaptists from another source, this time one of the Protestant reformers of the 16th century and after. Bullinger says, they henceforth lead their lives under a semblance of a quite spiritual conduct. They denounce covetousness, pride, profanity, the lewd conversation and immorality of the world, drinking and gluttony. In short, their hypocrisy is great and manifold. So once again, taking all of this data, it's quite a testimony to the Anabaptists that even their critics have to admit that much about them. But after all of that, he concludes his assessment by pointing out the hypocrisy of the Anabaptists, or at least alleging to the hypocrisy of the Anabaptists. And of course, this was the very thing that the Anabaptists loathed about the church, or one of the things, and something that they were trying to root out of their communities was this hypocrisy. But this is the very thing that Bullinger chooses to accuse them of with no real evidence to cite for it. Secondly, in terms of what we should expect from reconciliation, so these are like trying to fit 2 points here into this 1 point. Our endurance isn't tested on good days only. Revilers don't give us a break when we're hurting. Consider the situation David is in. He's just lost the throne to the kingdom. He's been exiled from the city that he loves. His own son, as he says in the passage, is seeking to kill him. And now, on top of this, he has, right before this story with Shimei, he has Mephibosheth's betrayal to think about. It's worth spending a minute just to unpack that. So if you forgot, at the beginning of the story, Mephibosheth's servant, Ziba, comes and brings all of these provisions to David and his men. And David's like, where's your master? That is, where's Mephibosheth? Where is this guy that I've showered so much kindness upon? Is he coming out to join me? And Ziba says, no, Mephibosheth is staying in Jerusalem because he said that the kingdom is going to be restored to him today. So Mephibosheth, as Ziba is portraying him in this story, Mephibosheth is expecting that this is his chance to reclaim the throne for himself. And in David's eyes, it looks as though Mephibosheth, this one whom he's shown so much kindness and the son of his best friend, Jonathan, has turned his back on him. It seems as though instead of coming out to be with him and side with him in his hour of need, Mephibosheth is hoping that this will turn out to his own advantage. And it seems as though Mephibosheth has turned his back on David. So David has all of this looming over him when Shimei comes bringing this reviling and cursing him in this way and throwing stones. It's not on David's best day after winning a mighty military victory. It's not while he has rest from his enemies and his throne is secure. It's not while he has the assurance that his friends have his back, but it's when he's in his lowest point. So all of that kind of builds out an idea of what we should expect from reviling. I expect that that's not too much of a surprise to people here, but if you feel like you haven't experienced much reviling to this point, this is kind of par for the course. We shouldn't be surprised or think that there's anything exceptional when it takes that shape. How should we respond to reviling when we experience it? This is the second point here. So if you're the one being reviled, then we see two lessons from David's example here. The first is that David regards reviling as a test from God. And because of that, he listens with discernment. Looking down at the second half of the passage we read today, David says twice that the Lord has told Shimei to bring this charge against him, which is a really odd thing to say because it's obviously a blatantly false charge, at least with respect to Saul's household. But David, even though he knows his dealings with Saul, he doesn't say, "Oh, I'm not going to listen to that. That's just nonsense." He actually takes this as a test from God, and more than that, as kind of a message from God. And I wouldn't say so if David didn't say, "For so the Lord has ordered him." And he says that right after, like, "Let him curse," as in the Lord has ordered him to curse. Obviously, we don't know whether or not David's statement represents the actual theology of what's going on behind the scenes, but it's remarkable that this is his instinctual response to assume that there's something God wants him to pay attention to here. So on the part of the one being reviled, we should receive these opportunities as a test from God and an opportunity to listen from discernment, to listen with discernment. Could there be some substance to the thing that the one reviling is saying here? Could there be some substance, even though on its face it seems absolutely ludicrous? This is the question that David's response calls to mind. I'll say as a caveat that it's the prerogative of the one who's being reviled to listen with discernment and to look for God's message in the midst of that. It's not the job of the bystanders who are with this person to assume maybe God has a message for you in this. Easy for you to say if you're not the one being reviled. This is something that is the privilege and the responsibility of the one being reviled. There might be things worse. It's pretty obnoxious when those who are comfortable on the sidelines are exhorting someone reviled to listen to the one reviling them. This is something that depends on the maturity of the one who's actually going through it. We'll see what the right response is for those on the sidelines in just a moment, or at least those who are not currently experiencing the attack. But a remarkable example of this is found in David Brainerd. How many people here are familiar with David Brainerd? How many have heard this name before? Okay, quite a few of you. So for those of you who don't know him, there's many details we can't go into, but he was a missionary to the Native Americans in this area who lived several centuries ago. And the remarkable thing that I want to point out from his life is this apology that he makes to someone who really took something that he said and used it as an opportunity to smear him and cause him great inconvenience. Brainerd was attending college, and as young people, myself included, are apt to do, said something about one of the professors that was rather unwise and ended up really offending this professor, who then complained and prevented him from graduating. And even after the most charitable apologies on the part of Brainerd that you could imagine, he was never able to graduate because of this one incident that just blew up and became something huge. And after writing out this lengthy apology, Brainerd writes, "God has given me that disposition that "If this were the case, that a man had done me 100 injuries, and I, though ever so much provoked to it, had done him one, I feel disposed and heartily willing to confess my fault to him, and on my knees to ask forgiveness of him, though at the same time he should justify himself in all the injuries he has done me, and should only make use of my humble confession to blacken my character the more and represent me as the only one guilty." When I read that, I was like, wow, I do not think that I have it in me to do that. And obviously, this is a work of the Spirit, and God gives us strength in the moment to do what is pleasing to him. But Brainerd's example here is remarkable, that just like David, he would not respond in kind with this reviling, but actually listens for what is the thing that I can learn from this, or what is the test here that I can overcome. And he's even willing to give the other person, through his apology, more fodder for them to use in their attacking him. The second lesson we learn from David, and the one that I think is really the central theme in this story and the one that we're going to turn to shortly, is that those reviled for righteousness can find strength in hoping for God's reward. Those reviled for righteousness can find strength in the hope of God's reward. After David acknowledges that God is testing him through Shimei, after he acknowledges that God has ordered Shimei to revile him in this way, he says in verse 12, "It may be that the Lord will look on my affliction, and that the Lord will repay me with good for his cursing this day." So David has this consciousness of God's eyes upon him, and he knows that he's living all of these experiences before someone who knows his heart, who sees all of the circumstances, and he's expecting here that if he bears this with patience, that God is going to take care of things for him. God is going to bring about some kind of reward for the reviling that he experiences. And this is in the midst of knowing that God is judging him in this time. We'll get to that aspect of things in a moment. David does not, there's nothing excusable about the way Shimei is insulting him and committing violence against him and his men in this way, but there's another side to it. And David, even knowing that God may be disciplining him in this time, still has confidence that God will reward him for his righteous bearing with this. Let's turn to the response for other people. How should, if you're not the one who's currently experiencing reviling, how should you respond to it? I think we have a great picture of the right response in the physical positioning of David's men, if not the course of action they were calling for. It says that while Shimei is throwing stones at David and at his servants, that all the people and all the mighty men were on his right hand and his left. And Shimei says, "Come out." So it's easy to pass over, but the picture I have of this is that these men are body blocking for David. David is somewhere in the middle of the group, and his mighty men and the people who are with him are on his right and his left. And it says that Shimei is throwing stones not just at David, but at his servants. And Shimei is calling David to come out, indicating perhaps that David is somewhat sheltered in his current position, and that he wants to be able to have a more direct shot at David. So while there's really nothing David's men can do to keep David from hearing these words of reproach that are coming against him, they are positioning themselves in such a way that they're also taking hits from the stones Shimei is throwing, and perhaps sparing David from most of that. It'd be pretty hard to hit someone who's in the middle of a large group of people who are standing on either side of him. So, figuratively speaking, the right response for you, if you're not being reviled, but you're seeing a brother or sister or someone close to you who is, the right response is to do whatever you can to come between them and the insults, verbal or physical, that are being hurled their way. And of course, it will never be as bad for the people who aren't the targets, but we can lessen the suffering of our brothers and sisters who are currently going through that. And I think in the past year or a couple years, there have been lots of positive examples of that. Theodore Roosevelt has a quote that I think is applicable in this situation, and also to the point before about being careful not to add criticism to those being reviled. He says, "It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles, or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat." So if the one in the arena is clearly the one being reviled in this situation, but we have a chance to some degree to join them in the arena if we will stand between the one reviling and the one being reviled, if we will show our solidarity, if we will accept to receive blows as a result of our association with the person who's under attack. That's the proper response for those who are seeing others being reviled. The fourth and semi-final point, what we should know about reviling. Now we can talk about the discipline side to this passage, because this is something that's really important for us to know, that adds a little bit of nuance to what it means to be reviled for righteousness. David, in a way, David was being disciplined in this passage. The whole affair with Absalom happened as a result of a real sin that David had committed that I think we're all very aware of, and that is the Bathsheba incident. God said to David that as a result of this, the sword would never depart from his household, and David lost more than one son as a result of God's discipline in this area, as a result of his sin, I should say. So David's fleeing Jerusalem, his losing the throne, is an act of God's disciplining him. God said in the Davidic covenant that if those of the house of David commit iniquity, that God would chasten them with the rod of men. And this is God chastening David with the rod of men. So there is a real sense in which David is being disciplined for sin. But I think we can also see very clearly in this passage that he's being reviled for righteousness with respect to how he dealt with the house of Saul and the reception that he's getting that contrasts with that. So the takeaway here is that discipline for sin and reviling for righteousness can happen at the same time. We can easily separate these things in our minds where we think we might be conscious of some sin we've committed in the past, or maybe in the very thing that we're being reviled for, we do have at least some share of the blame, however small. We may have acknowledged it as well. But just because someone is being disciplined for sin, that doesn't disqualify them from being someone who is capable of being reviled for righteousness. Both can happen simultaneously. And we see that in this passage. So if you're the one being reviled, it's easy to, and you're conscious of whatever sin you have, whether related to the problem immediately at hand or not so much related, it's easy to beat yourself up and to know that because in a general sense you are deserving of discipline, to think that then the suffering that you're experiencing or the reviling you're experiencing can't be because of righteousness. You can be. There's also such a thing as being reviled for and being wholly deserving of it, or being reviled for evil deeds, and that's not commendable. But there are situations where someone can be disciplined for sin, but also as a general pattern of their life, if it is characterized by righteousness, then they are indeed suffering for righteousness at the same time. The second thing to know about reviling is that it makes us weary, even when we respond how God intends. I think David's response in this passage to Shimei's reviling is about as righteous of a response as one can have, especially for the Old Covenant era. There's a sense in which, given the revelation that he had, that it would have been very understandable for him to order the execution of Shimei here. But he chooses not to do that. His response is exemplary, especially for his time. And yet we read at the end of this passage that the king and all the people who were with him became weary, and they refreshed themselves at the place that they were traveling to when they arrived there. It's easy to imagine how walking along this dusty road, hearing endless blood-curdling insults and receiving stone after stone would weary both David and the people. And it's important for us to know that when we are reviled, it's easy to just feel like it's easy to beat ourselves up if we experience loss of motivation, if we experience doubt about the mission that we're doing, or if we're someone who's thicker skinned, it might be easy to just try to press on despite the reviling. And what we see here is that even if we respond in the right way, it makes us weary, and we need to take additional time or extra time on top of our usual baseline to rest, to recharge, to seek refuge in God in order to avoid the burnout that comes from failing to do those things, failing to take into account the wearisomeness of this kind of trial. And finally, about reviling here under this last heading, being rewarded doesn't mean regaining everything we've lost. Sometimes we might not see the rewards immediately. Sometimes we might not even see them in this life. Sometimes we do have very tangible examples of God rewarding us in response for bearing these trials. And that is a wonderful thing. And God, in his wisdom, knows when we need that. And he also knows when to delay that or when to withhold that until the future age. Notice that David does not presume that God's reward will come to him in a very obvious and immediate way. He says, it may be that the Lord will look on my affliction. And I think in part he knows that this is because he's being disciplined as well. But he has that hope even while avoiding stepping into the realm of presumption. So David is aware that the reward may not come in the time frame that he wants it, nor in the way that he wants it, but he still knows that there's this principle that God rewards the righteous who are insulted unjustly. For in order to build out this point a little bit more about the nature of the reward, I'd like to turn to the companion passage, which is in 2 Samuel 19. We'll start in verse 16, just a few pages over. 2 Samuel 19, verse 16. This is after David's army has had victory against Absalom, and David is returning to Jerusalem, which in itself is part of the answer to David's expectation for a reward. Verse 16 says, and Shimei, the son of Gera, a Benjamite, who is from Bahurim, obviously the same guy, hastened and came down with the men of Judah to meet King David. There were 1,000 men of Benjamin with him, and Ziba, the servant of the house of Saul, and his 15 sons, and his 20 servants with him. And they went over the Jordan before the king. Then a ferry boat went across to carry over the king's household and to do what he thought good. Now Shimei, the son of Gera, fell down before the king when he had crossed the Jordan. Then he said to the king, do not let my lord impute iniquity to me, or remember what wrong your servant did on the day that my lord the king left Jerusalem, that the king should take it to heart. For I, your servant, know that I have sinned. Therefore, here I am, the first to come today of all the house of Joseph to go down to meet my lord the king. But Abishai, the son of Zeruiah, answered and said, shall not Shimei be put to death for this, because he cursed the Lord's anointed? And David said, what have I to do with you, you sons of Zeruiah, that you should be adversaries to me today? Shall any man be put to death today in Israel? For do I not know that today I am king over Israel? Therefore the king said to Shimei, you shall not die. And the king swore to him. Now Mephibosheth, the son of Saul, came down to meet the king, and he had not cared for his feet, nor trimmed his mustache, nor washed his clothes from the day the king departed until the day he came back in peace. So it was, when he had come to Jerusalem to meet the king, that the king said to him, why did you not go with me, Mephibosheth? And he answered, my lord, O king, my servant deceived me, for your servant said, I will saddle a donkey for myself, that I may ride on it and go to the king, because your servant is lame. And he has slandered your servant to my lord the king. But my lord the king is like the angel of God. Therefore, do what is good in your eyes. For all of my father's house were but dead men before my lord the king. Yet you set your servant among those who eat at your own table. Therefore, what right have I still to cry out any more to the king? So the king said to him, why do you speak any more of your matters? I have said, you and Ziba divide the land. Then Mephibosheth said to the king, rather let him take it all, inasmuch as my lord the king has come back in peace to his own house. Okay, that's a long passage here. I'm not going to draw as much out of this as the first passage, but going back to the point about reviling, wearying us. I think we can see that in David's response to Mephibosheth. It's easy to ask, why does David seem so terse or kind of harsh with Mephibosheth, where he says, "Why do you speak any more of your matters? I've said, you and Ziba divide the land." It's clear that Mephibosheth was slandered. We can see that in his neglect of his body, and the fact that he was lame, and it's a rather convincing story that he was unable to go out to David because of Ziba's deceit. I'm not going to spend too long building the case, but I think it's fairly intuitive here that Mephibosheth was not betraying David the way that Ziba had painted him as doing so. He was not the one that Ziba portrayed him as, but that he never betrayed David and that his desire was to go and be with him. Even so, it seems like David and Mephibosheth's friendship is strained from this. And this is one of the insidious things about slander, is that sometimes the damage to someone's reputation is never fully compensated for. And we see that not one, but two people are experiencing reviling, David from Shimei and Mephibosheth from his servant Ziba, who tried to deceive David about Mephibosheth's true loyalties. So we see here that although Mephibosheth is vindicated, he ends up losing half of his estate, and because he doesn't choose to claim the other half, he ends up losing his entire estate. And the remarkable thing is that he seems quite satisfied just with the fact that David is safely back in Jerusalem, which is once again something that should indicate to us his true colors. But he loses in this situation. His relationship with David is strained. He loses the estate that David had given to him. And as a result, I think we can say that Mephibosheth, in the story that we read about, doesn't receive the reward for reviling that we would expect. David also suffers in that his relationship with Jonathan's son is strained. And while David regains the kingship, he loses his son, Absalom, in the process. Once again, not the only one of his sons that he lost. And so we see the nuance in this story that while we can expect a reward from God, we don't know when that reward is going to come, and we don't know if we will see it fulfilled in our days. David would not see his full reward, and yet his reward would arrive 1,000 years later in another son of David. And it's with that picture that I want to continue the line of thought here. You all know, of course, who I'm talking about. There's several points of discontinuity, or several points of continuity first, and several points of discontinuity between David and how he handles reviling, his example in that, and between the example of Jesus, of whom David is a picture. Once again, in his time, and even from an objective standpoint, David is remarkable in how he responds to this situation. But I think observing the comparison with Jesus will give us appreciation for a totally new way of handling reviling. So first, let's talk about the ways in which David and Jesus are similar. Both were falsely accused. Both were accused of the very things which any sane person could see. This is the most ludicrous kind of accusation. David was accused of being a bloodthirsty man, while his history with the house of Saul showed otherwise. And Jesus was accused of being a blasphemer, while he did nothing other than glorify his father. David kept his men from executing Shimei. Jesus stayed his followers from fighting back when he was arrested. David could have ordered his men to kill Shimei. Jesus could have summoned legions of angels to slay his foes. David was reviled on his way out of Jerusalem, which had rejected him from being their king. And so also was Jesus. David was reviled on his worst day, and Jesus was also reviled in the depths of his humiliation while he hung on the cross. Both received a reward from God and were installed as king as a result of their righteousness. David was reinstalled as king, and Jesus was installed as the promised king to Israel and as the king of the world. But there are also points of discontinuity or dissimilarity. David was not without sin and in need of discipline. Jesus was without sin and not in need of discipline. David's men made a shield around him and absorbed some of the blows. Jesus' followers fled, leaving him to face the persecution alone. And finally, Jesus not only pardons his revilers, which would be impressive in itself, that's what David does with Shimei, but Jesus actually invites his revilers to share in his reward. In conclusion, I think that these two stories show us that God rewards those who receive reviling in return for righteousness. And reviewing some of the major points here, we see that reviling hits us where it hurts and it comes to us on our worst days. When reviled, we should consider it as a test from God, and we should listen with discernment for what we can learn even from the mouths of our accusers. We should wait patiently for and expectantly for God's reward. When we see others reviled, we should stand with them and share in some of their injuries and their insults. When we see others reviled, we should recognize that someone can be disciplined for sin and reviled for righteousness at the same time. It's not an all or nothing kind of deal here. We should not be surprised when reviling wearies us, but we need to expect that and to make additional space for rest in our lives. And we should maintain our hope in God's reward, even when that reward is delayed or it feels partial or it feels inadequate to the sufferings that we've gone through. And finally, following the example of Christ, we should pray for our revilers that they might share in Christ's reward. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for the compelling and convicting example of David and his response to this. I thank you for the even greater example of Jesus. I pray, Father, that these words would be edifying to those who hear. I pray that you would help us, God, to not suffer for evil, not suffer for our own character flaws. I pray that we would suffer for righteousness, God, that though our enemies might not have anything of substance to say about us, I pray, God, that you would give us the privilege of being able to suffer for Christ's name and to bear it well. And I pray, God, that our reward would be the souls of those who even revile us, that our lives would be a more perfect testimony to who Jesus is in his name.